Green Bay's choice for news talk. 1590 AM and 97.9 FM WGBW.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packard. Ukraine's President Zelensky ready to trade his presidency for peace. ABC's Patrick Reeval in Kyiv.
And our colleague Ian Pannell was able to put a question to him, asking him if he would step down as president if that meant peace for Ukraine. And Zelensky replied that he would, and that he would do so if Ukraine were to be offered NATO membership.
This ahead of tomorrow's third anniversary of Russia's invasion of that country, concerned that Russia might try and mark the anniversary with some kind of larger attack. Sunday Mass at New York St. Patrick's Cathedral and around the world, Catholics offering a special prayer for Pope Francis. The 88-year-old pontiff is in hospitalized critical condition, the Vatican reporting that a blood test of the Pope shows early kidney failure. Elon Musk's latest email to federal workers, what'd you get done this week, telling them justify their jobs by email tomorrow or consider themselves gone. This is ABC News. A hospital shooting in York County, Pennsylvania Saturday, ending with a police officer killed, multiple others injured at UPMC Memorial west of Philadelphia. ABC's Christian Cordero at the scene.
And be advised, we have two officers hit by gunfire.
According to officials, the gunman, Diogenes Archangel Ortiz, entered UPMC Hospital in York, Pennsylvania, around 10:30 a.m., armed with a handgun and zip ties. Adding, Ortiz tied the hands of one hospital staff member behind her back as police responded to the scene.
Authorities say no patients were injured. Investigators are still searching for a motive. An emergency landing at LAX, a Delta Airlines flight with more than 160 passengers on board leaving from Los Angeles for Sydney, had to turn around 30 minutes into its trip after smoke was detected in the galley. The airline saying no one was hurt. Passengers were rebooked on other flights. Kamala Harris receiving the prestigious Chairman's Prize at Saturday's NAACP Image Awards. Dave Packer, ABC News.
Are record energy costs putting a squeeze on your fixed or limited incomes? With limited incomes not keeping up with the lingering effects of inflation, you might be one of tens of thousands of Wisconsin residents who are struggling to survive in the blistering heat of summer or the bitter cold of winter. While you haven't asked for it, the Keep Wisconsin Warm Cool Fund and your local energy assistance providers are here to help. No Wisconsin resident should ever have to face the challenge of living without heat or power or face homelessness. For a hand up, apply today and call 1-800-506-5596. That's 800-506-5596. Or visit www.kwwf.org.
Lisa Hale with WGBW News. Your news in depth. Find it in the news section at WGBW.fm.
For Civic Media News, I'm Savannah Tomei Olson. The retirement savings picture across America is generally bleak. Not a lot of people have a big nest egg to rely on. Could more pensions be the answer? Mike Moen reports.
Pensions offered to public employees are seen as more stable because they're not shaken by movements in the financial markets. In recent polling from the National Institute on Retirement Security, 86% of Americans say all workers, including the private sector, should have a retirement plan that is more pension-driven. The group's Dan Doonan says retirement coverage is still too spotty for non-wealthy workers, leaving them on their own to put away savings.
In general, we're just asking way too much of individuals to get all this right. And saving during the middle years of your life to provide income throughout retirement, it really is a challenging endeavor.
He says the good news is that more states are setting up programs that enroll private sector workers in an IRA-style plan. The goal is to step in when a company can't or won't offer retirement perks. Experts say they're easy for states to operate and benefit small businesses because they don't have to contribute. But for the workers, the IRAs typically have lower contribution limits, meaning the retirement savings might not stretch as far. And just like state and local governments, Doonan says a more simplified network of retirement programs around the country can help companies in the private sector avoid staff turnover.
If they do move in that direction, I think what you'll see is more loyalty in return to the company. So there are some benefits for private employers especially employers who value retention.
This is Mike Moen. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
And this is Civic Media News. I'm Savannah Tome Olson.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. A partly sunny sky across the area for today and light winds. Couple of flurries out there as well. Highs reaching the middle 30s. For tonight, clouds will stick around. A little light wintry mix in spots. Lows in the lower 30s. It's 33 at our studios.
Maggie Dawn.
Monday, we kick off at 2 p.m. with a discussion of Maggie's Metrics. What makes local officials and elected judges good, bad, or just downright ugly? We discuss next.
The Maggie Dawn Show. Weekday afternoons from 2 till 4. From De Pere to Suamico, 97.9 WGBW.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel, Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is Amicus, a law review on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. And yes, my name is Jim Santel. I am your host on this broadcast, both this hour and next hour, where we undertake to do some analysis, some assessment, some description, some reporting on some of the major rule of law and justice related stories of the previous days, sometimes weeks. And we've got lots of them in this edition of Amicus, a law review. We also, this weekend, as always, invite your comments, your questions, your inquiries, your observations about the subject matters on our aggressive but achievable syllabus. That number here at Civic Media is 855-752-4842. One more time, that's 855-752-4842. I am joined in the studios of Civic Media here in Radio Park in Racine, but broadcasting throughout the state of Wisconsin and beyond by my terrific producer, Greg. And together, we are going to take those calls, those questions, those inquiries of yours as we begin to attack this large but achievable syllabus that we have adopted for ourselves on this weekend broadcast. Delighted and honored that you have chosen to spend some of your weekend time with Greg and me as we undertake exactly that. The name of our broadcast, as you know, Amicus, that's a legal word. That's also a Latin word for friend. You add curiae to it. That means friend of the court. We take our name from the notion that in judicial proceedings, it's often the case, even some of those that are pending right now in America and frankly around the globe, when there are times when a party is in need of additional assistance and direction and counsel, and especially when the judge, the court, is in need of some additional insight or perspective on the issue. Parties who are interested in the matter but are not formally a part of the litigation, they're not a defendant, they're not a plaintiff in the case, will file a brief, and those are called amicus briefs, friend of the court brief. And the notion is that this is information we're offering to you, judge or judicial system generally, about something in which we've got a special interest, a special expertise. Friend of the court, friend generally of the community, and that's where we get our name, Amicus, a law review, hoping that in our ambitious discussion every weekend of the law and of justice, of government issues as well, we can not only be your friend, but also provide that friendly advice and counsel, direction, suggestions about ways in which to understand the world around us. That's where we get our name. And indeed, that notion of Amicus, a friend to you, a friend to understand understanding and comprehension also animates what is a very ambitious agenda, including in this special edition of Amicus, a law review, a fair amount of history, a history this weekend necessitated by, yes, indeed, something that happened on Tuesday of this past week. From my perspective and the perspective of others, not getting nearly as much attention as it should in the midst of what is admittedly a fire hose of executive orders and actions and other things that are animating our understanding of government, our bewilderment from time to time about what government is doing. It is a lot, as we often say on this broadcast, but something happened. Something happened on Tuesday that should have all of us wildly concerned, agitated, distressed. And it, yes, indeed, it comes from the pen of the President of the United States of America. We're going to spend a lot of time talking about the historical precedents for those, the antecedents of what the president did, and then explain why it is that what he did in issuing executive order that basically now brings to an end the literal sense of separation of powers and checks and balances in America, explain that and describe for you how, while many people may think that's hyperbole, maybe people may say, well, gosh, Jim, that's over the top. He hasn't done that. Nothing has happened. The Republic hasn't crumbled since Tuesday. The President of the United States of America on Tuesday of this past week declared himself the king, declared himself the authoritarian government leader. And we're going to talk about the precedents, again, the antecedents of those things, going way back to a French king. His name, of course, Louis XIV, King of France, allegedly, probably this is apocryphal, said, "I am the state, l'état c'est moi, l'état c'est moi." That's probably how you recall the expression from your civics classes when you were in high school, maybe college, maybe middle school, maybe grade school. The king at that time in France, Louis XIV, declaring himself the state, l'état c'est moi, I am the state. Now, as a part of our historical analysis here, we should note it may well be that Louis XIV got a bad rap about all that. It may well be that that's apocryphal, that he may not have said it. Indeed, when he died, the last words purportedly attributed to him say, "I die, but the state will always remain," which suggests that maybe either he had some of a convergence along the way as he was dying, or maybe he never said that. But nonetheless, the concept is that a king in the past established himself as the state. Keep that in mind as we talk in this weekend broadcast about what our President of the United States of America said in 2025, declaring himself the state, declaring himself the only person who can articulate and enforce the law in America, the only person who can tell us how that law should be interpreted, and describe for us the consequences if the interpretations that he and, yes, his attorney general adopt and advance for all of us are not followed, the consequences that happened if we do not, in fact, acknowledge that the state is the president, completely contrary to nearly 250 years of our nation's history. We're going to spend a lot of time talking about l'état c'est moi and this major, major executive order issued by President Donald Trump on Tuesday of this past week. It has some parallels, plainly, not only in history, but right down the street at Main Justice, where Pam Bondi is now our attorney general. We're going to talk about one of the many, many orders that she has issued. We have spent some time in previous editions of Amicus, a law review, talking about many of the changes that she has affected there. I'm going to highlight just one of those today, which changes the ways in which federal prosecutors around our nation, United States attorneys in the Eastern District of Wisconsin, the Western District of Wisconsin, in all of the other districts throughout the United States and its territories, what is the standard by which they decide whether or not a case should be presented to a grand jury, whether a case should be charged by that federal grand jury? She changed that recently. We'll talk about that significant change again, announcing what the law is, announcing what the policy is that changes the ways in which our government works based upon this notion that the president and, yes, indeed, the attorney general are the ones who articulate what the law is and no one else, placing in perspective, minimizing the perspective of the Congress and, yes, indeed, the United States Supreme Court. We're going to begin there by talking once again about what the Supreme Court did way back in July to set all of this up, to establish for the first time in our nation's history that we do have a supreme presidency. We'll talk once again, as we necessarily need to do, telling you about what John Roberts said about the imperial presidency, the authority established by the Supreme Court in the executive branch. And the result of all of this is the continuing collapse of the republic and the system of checks and balances that we've adopted and that have animated our government for 250 years. A lot to unpack there necessarily during our broadcast this weekend. We'll talk a little bit about some other things also in the rule of law ambit. That includes a little bit of return to the United States Supreme Court, some assessment again of what's going on there on the other side of Capitol Hill, across the parking lot from the Congress. We'll chat about at least one case that they decided this week having to do with international claims in the federal courts, a unanimous decision, believe it or not, among the many that are going to be coming out in May and June, maybe even in July, about 64 cases right now on the docket of our United States Supreme Court. We'll talk about some other things along the way that also animate our understanding of the rule of law in America, here in Wisconsin and beyond. All of that coming up on Amicus, a law review. And again, Greg and I taking your questions, your comments, your observations at 855-752-4842. Let's begin our analysis, our very sobering reporting on what happened this past week. We know that the nation has experienced in ways large, small, and in between the consequences of this president issuing a myriad of executive orders. It is coming at breakneck speed, and we know it's difficult. It is virtually impossible to keep track of all of this. In future editions of Amicus Law Review, we're going to do some rule of law snapshots simply to update you on where many of the challenges are to these various executive orders across the board, having to do with money, having to do with finances, having to do with our international status, our domestic programs, our employees, our civil servants, all those kinds of things. And we know along the way that there are federal judges who are continuing to focus on these kinds of things. We know just in recent days that a federal judge named Jeanette Vargas has extended a pause, an injunction, and a 64-page decision that extends a preliminary injunction preventing DOGE, the Department of Government Efficiency, which really doesn't exist, from accessing, yes, that's right, the Treasury Department payment records, and establishing once again a guardrail against what is happening there at the Treasury Department, telling Elon Musk and DOGE you can't get access. That's one decision that just came up, a federal judge pushing back on this imperial presidency. Federal judge just late this past week also, his name is Adam Abelson. He has granted a preliminary injunction blocking the administration from terminating or changing federal contracts that are considered DEI equity related. Again, serving up a blow to this DEI prohibition that Donald Trump has also put in place. Many other things happening in our federal courts. The judges are responding to those, as we've advocated in the past. They are the bulwark. They are, in many ways, our safeguard against these kinds of unconstitutional and unlawful actions. As we come back, however, we're going to talk about this attempt and this statement by our president just this past week, even in the midst of all of this, to declare himself our king in the tradition of a King Louis XIV and of other kings in our past tradition. All of that coming up in this edition of Amicus, a Law Review.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home for Matinee on Air.
I'm Dan Schaefer. Let's recombobulate. Wisconsin's next major election is already here. The race for state Supreme Court is ramping up with just a few weeks to go before the April 1st general election. Much like the race 2 years ago, this will determine the balance of power on the court. If Susan Crawford wins, the court remains in liberal control. If Brad Schimmel wins, the court flips back to a right-wing majority. But there are a number of differing dynamics from the race in 2023. That race, won by Janet Protasiewicz, was the culmination of a years-long effort for liberals to win control of the court. Now they're playing defense to keep that majority. This also begins a run of 6 years in a row with a race for Wisconsin Supreme Court on the spring election ballot. Because of which justices will be up in coming years, if Crawford wins this year, the court will likely remain in liberal control until at least 2028. Find more bigger picture analysis of the race in my latest column at the Recombobulation Area.
The Talk of Green Bay, WGBW.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus, a law review. My name is Jim Santel, along with my terrific producer, Greg. We are taking your inquiries and your questions here at Civic Media. That number, you can call in, you can text in as well and be a part of our discussion. That telephone number, 855-752-4842. Be a part of that discussion. Greg and I, delighted to have you be a part of our Amicus discussion, our analysis, which this weekend, as it is in many weekends of recent times, a sobering reporting. Let's go back and talk a little bit about what has happened, give it some historical perspective here. Over the past month, a little bit more than a month since President Trump has been the chief executive of our nation, we know that he has issued many, many executive orders of various natures, changing the way that government works, reestablishing not only his own view of the government, but changing the manner in which the government itself works, affecting not only federal employees, but affecting our posture in the world, domestically. Huge numbers of things that have been going on in our nation, raising an awful lot of not just legal challenges, but again, in recent days, our communities also responding. We have seen these protests across the nation here in Wisconsin, other places on all of our major states, all the states of our union, in virtually all major cities, people coming into the streets and protesting these kinds of things and saying that the government should not be doing them based upon substantive reasons. But also implicit, if not explicit, in all of that is this notion that the president is now exercising authorities not given to him by the Constitution, not contemplated by our founding fathers, not contemplated by our history. We know, of course, as we have said as late as our previous broadcast, that the Supreme Court in July of last year described the presidency as being hugely powerful in ways that we had not seen before that July 1 order. The Chief Justice in particular talking about this hugely muscular executive branch seeking to encourage the Supreme Court is energetic, vigorous, decisive, and speedy execution of the laws by placing in the hands of a singular, constitutionally indispensable executive, cannot be bothered by other things, and therefore hugely empowered to do things the previous presidents have never been given the authority to do. That comes out of that Supreme Court case, Trump versus United States, back in July, just about 8 months or so ago. Donald Trump picking up on that plainly and exercising the power given to him by the Supreme Court, and also exercising power that comes in the wake of a huge amount of history. And so, in what is something of a departure from our previous discussions about the law as it exists today, our understandings of government and the administration of justice inside and outside the halls of government, I'm going to spend some time this broadcast giving us some history already spoken about Louis XIV, L'état, c'est moi, arguably the statement of this French judge, a French king, who also thought of himself as a judge, but the French king declaring himself arguably the head of the state. We know that all of this also has some prior history. King James I of England, establishes the same kind of thing in an interesting work he published in 1598. It was called The True Law of Free Monarchies. You can probably tell by the very title of that publication that this is not going to go well for the people of 16th century England. He said this. He said, "Kings emerged before any estates or ranks of men, before any parliaments were beholden to the world, before any laws were made, and by them was the land distributed," by them meaning kings, "which at first was wholly theirs," meaning the king held everything and by his largesse would distribute those lands. "And so it follows," King James I wrote way back in 1598, "so it follows of necessity that kings are the authors and the makers of the laws, and not the laws of the kings." That's King James I of 1598, and offering this broadcast that we are returning to that articulation of the way that government works. Now, acting on that theory, your historical professors, your history professors will tell you, as many of you, I suspect, know, he ruled without parliament for long periods. He granted dispensations from statutory laws for various people who were seeking to appeal to his interests and his proclivities, his majesty as the government itself. He administered the law through what are called prerogative courts, meaning they would exist only insofar as he permitted them to do so. And the rules that they announced, the decisions that they made, were derived from the will of the king, James I. His son, his name, you may recall, Charles I, was even more convinced. He was convinced by his father's writings, the things that James I did, but even more convinced of this absolute authority in the king. And he established that by not only resenting those populations, it suggests that maybe this should be pulled back, but in 1642, Parliament took up arms in a civil war that ended with Charles' execution and Oliver Cromwell's Commonwealth. The people, the Parliament rose up against Charles I and said, "No more. We cannot have this. This is not our tradition. Your father was wrong. You are wrong." And Charles I lost his life. That's where Cromwell came into power in the Commonwealth. And after the monarchy, again, years later, skipping over lots of history, 1660, British kings and queens ever after acknowledged that statutory law could only be made by the Crown and Parliament acting together, acting in concert. The king, contrary to what James said, contrary to what Charles said that prompted his losing his head, literally, in 1660, British kings and the queens that follow acknowledging that they've got at least a shared responsibility when it comes to establishing what the law is. Statutes bound the monarch's official actions, and what the law was then restricted their ability to do what they otherwise wanted to do. Here's the significant point coming out of, once again, 1660 in England. Interpretations of the laws, primarily of functions of, yes, that's right, judges, judicial officers who base their decisions on statutes and precedent and not the will of the monarch. That in the wake of James and Charles, 1660, again, Parliament beginning to establish its authority and saying, nope, you've got some shared responsibility here, but we're the ones who are going to establish the law. And oh, by the way, judges also very responsible for doing just thing. The next great constitutional upheaval in Britain, the Glorious Revolution of 1688, displaced King James II in favor of his daughter. You know her name. Her name is Mary. And to gain the throne, to acquire the support of the people at that time, The monarch Mary had to accept the English Bill of Rights. Yes, once again, an establishment of the laws of the land that said that the monarch was not absolute. Among other things, it abolished the royal power to nullify statutory laws, either in general or specifically. It prohibited the king, in this case the queen, from doing exactly what she wanted under any circumstances. Parliament at that time, get this, also changed the royal coronation oath to include a requirement that monarchs swore to govern according to the laws enacted by Parliament. That's where it comes from. When Amicus, a law review, continues, more of this history that leads up, yes, indeed, to Tuesday of this last week, where an incredibly stunning and scary thing happened. Stay with us.
From Hobart to Bay Settlement, 97.9 WGBW.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. Ukraine's President Zelensky ready to trade his presidency for peace. ABC's Patrick Reval in Kyiv.
And our colleague Ian Pannell was able to put a question to him, asking him if he would step down as president if that meant peace for Ukraine. And Zelensky replied that he would, and that he would do so if Ukraine were to be offered NATO membership.
This ahead of tomorrow's third anniversary of Russia's invasion of that country, concerned that Russia might try and mark the anniversary with some kind of larger attack. Sunday Mass at New York St. Patrick's Cathedral and around the world, Catholics offering a special prayer for Pope Francis. The 88-year-old pontiff is in hospitalized critical condition, the Vatican reporting that a blood test of the Pope shows early kidney failure. Elon Musk's latest email to federal workers, what'd you get done this week, telling them justify their jobs by email tomorrow or consider themselves gone. This is ABC News.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
The Badgers lose in overtime. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. Men's college basketball, the number 11th ranked Wisconsin Badgers losing to Oregon 77-73. It ended a five-game winning streak for the Badgers, who host the Washington Huskies on Tuesday. Head coach Greg Gard.
That's credit to Oregon. We didn't attack the pressure. We got us to walk the ball up and play slower. So we'll learn from this and quickly turn the page for Tuesday night. But again, what got us in trouble was the completely kind of taking our foot off the gas offensively for whatever reason.
Baseball, in the first day of Cactus League action, the Brewers beat the Reds 8-7 thanks to a pair of home runs by infielder Vinny Capra.
I was just focused on the process. You know, I didn't have the greatest BP, and I just said I'm just going to go out into the game and try and do what I can and just focus on the ball, focus on the pitcher, and focus on approach, and just got to do what I can, and it ended up being a good day.
That's the Brewers' Vinny Capra. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. A partly sunny sky across the area for today and light winds. Couple of flurries out there as well. Highs reaching the middle 30s. For tonight, clouds will stick around. A little light wintry mix in spots. Lows in the lower 30s. It's 33 at our studios.
Do you hear that? Asthma triggers are everywhere, from dust mites, pet dander, and pollen, to smog and smoke. An asthma attack can strike anywhere, anytime. Be prepared with quick-acting Primatene Mist. Clinically proven to open airways quickly. It's the number one FDA-approved asthma inhaler available over-the-counter. Primatene Mist. Breathe easy again. Use as directed.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. Mississippi has one of the country's worst records for protecting voting rights and advancing democracy reforms. So when pro-voter bills emerge from the state House and Senate, like in-person early voting and the ability to cure a mismatched absentee signature, democracy advocates take notice. Mississippi is one of only three states without some form of in-person early voting, along with Alabama and New Hampshire. The Mississippi Free Press reports that February 12th, the Mississippi Senate passed SB 2654, allowing 15 days of early voting, ending the Saturday before the election at noon. The Republican-sponsored bill passed 39-12, but even if the House advances, it may still be vetoed by Mississippi Governor Tate Reeves, who accused the bill's sponsor of making the state's elections less secure. The Mississippi House also took some positive steps. HB 1419 prohibits moving or closing a polling place location within 60 days of an election, sometimes used as a voter suppression tactic. HB 163 sets rules for absentee ballots where the signature on file doesn't match the signed outer ballot envelope and would give the voter a chance to cure the problem. And HB 288 would make each county's five election commissioners nonpartisan positions. All three bills now move to the Senate. We have more on these bills and local reporting at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.
Mino and the Mayor.
On Monday's show, we'll get the weather forecast with Brittany Merlot, and we'll learn about the 7th annual Shamrock Beer Invitational at the Automobile Gallery with Justin Knitt.
And we kick off the Mino and the Mayor Top Craft Pick promotion with the Kerrigan Brothers Winery in Kakana.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel, and I'm your host for this hour and next hour as well. We're spending some special time in this broadcast talking about the history of authoritarianism around the world and historically our own precedents, our history that goes back to England, and describing the ways in which the notion of a completely authoritarian king has devolved over time to establish the authority of a governing principle that says that, yes, indeed, it's Parliament. It's a Congress that establishes the law, shared responsibilities between an executive and legislators, and also involving judges. Spending some time this broadcast talking about that, leading up to the notion, again, under Queen Mary, that the royal coronation included an acknowledgement that the queen was not the mere maker of the law, but the upholder of the law. And in fact, it's Parliament in concert with the queen or the king, who had responsibility to establish laws in the first place. And so that gets us to a year called 1776 and the decision by our founding fathers that what was going on with King George III could not be tolerated, that he was stepping over that line that had evolved from a time of James I and Charles II, a complete authoritarian monarchy. The George III principles being articulated at the time, establishing laws without representation. We've heard about that, of course, during our own remembrances of history as we were growing up. The notion, of course, was that the king himself is not inviolate in terms of capacity to not only enforce the law, but even enact the law. And so our founders wanted both popular participation in the choice of rulers, that's called democracy, and also the rule of law, again, adopting in many ways what had been the movement of history overseas in Great Britain, acknowledging that kings, executives, do not have complete authority to make decisions as they want. They were nervous about the risks inherent in pure democracy, particularly the historical phenomenon of the demagogue who manipulated the passions of an ill-informed majority who did not understand what things were really about, to establish and reestablish a monarchy beyond the control of law. That's exactly what James Madison and others wrote about at the time of our founding. And this is the point. Regardless of how you feel about politics today, regardless of how you align yourself on what side of the political aisle or even on the spectrum, the notion is that what we are seeing out of this White House is contrary, is expressly contrary to what our founding fathers not only contemplated, but wrote about. And Republicans and Democrats alike, everyone in between, all parties should be animated beyond belief about what is happening in Washington again just this past week, which we will now get to. The background of this, of course, is that our founding fathers created a system of checks and balances that include, of course, a Congress, you know that well, a legislature that is responsible for creating the law, an executive branch called the presidency, not the king, the presidency, that's responsible for executing the law, for making it happen, and yes, indeed, also tempered by a judicial branch, and requiring significantly that when we inaugurate a president to this day, that that president take an oath to the Constitution saying this, "I do solemnly swear that I will, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States of America." That's a shorthand way of saying I am not an authoritarian leader, that I am subject to the checks and balances of the other branches, also gathered, frankly, right before me as the president on Inauguration Day. The fears that an executive would become a dictator are real. And so that's the reason why, as a part of the advocacy for the adoption of the Constitution, this tripart separation of powers, the authors of the Federalist Papers said this is not establishing what Charles II and what James I embraced many, many years ago. This is a separation of those rules and principles upon all branches of government. And so when President Trump just this past week executed this major new executive order, he also along the way talked about himself as being the person who's responsible for establishing what the law is. We'll get to some of that language in just a few moments. When Donald Trump quotes Napoleon, this declaration that he who saves the country does not violate any law, he's actually quoting Napoleon Bonaparte. He adopts the view of an undoubted despot, a man who was despised by our own founding fathers. That language was repugnant to our founding fathers. It was indeed the language of Napoleon Bonaparte and of arguably Louis XIV, and yes, James and Charles, the kings of England. Thomas Jefferson significantly wrote in a letter to John Adams in 1815 that Napoleon, who said these kinds of things, was a usurper. He was an autocrat. He was a despot who was possessed of a tyrannical soul and a ravenous thirst for human blood. That's our leader. That's Thomas Jefferson way back when. And again, regardless of how you think things have played out in America, whatever your political alliances, your perspectives are, which we respect across the board, the reality is that anyone looking at what the President of the United States of America did this past week has got to understand that this articulation, this reclaiming of authority by the president, is contrary not only to now hundreds of years of history, but the basis upon which our nation has been built. Now, Article 3 of the Constitution, we know well, we've talked about that a lot on this broadcast, established, of course, a great deal of authority and judges. But they recognized, our founding fathers did, that the judges did not have all of the numbers, the expertise, the insight to do everything they needed to do. And so what happened was over time, especially in recent years, going back certainly to the FDR period, a little bit before, certainly after that, they established also all kinds of agencies. And the agencies, of course, are responsible for implementing what the Congress does. Why? Because Congress announces in its legislation broad principles. They can't address every little manifestation of the law in Wisconsin, in California, in Louisiana, in North Carolina. And so they establish this notion of agencies. And yes, many of them are inside the executive branch. Those are the cabinet officers, right? Those are the Department of Transportation, of Justice, of Commerce, of Labor, of Agriculture, right? Of Education, all those kinds of agencies inside the executive branch. And they also significantly created a huge number of independent agencies, independent of the executive branch, by commission, by design. And the concept there, once again, was not only that these agencies, both inside the executive branch and those that are independent of the president, should be able to bring into their ambit, into their employment ranks, people with expertise. How often have we talked about that on this broadcast? People who know what they're talking about, the experts, the scientists, the mathematicians, yes, the farmers, the labor authorities, the people inside the Department of Justice and state, inside of the Department of Energy, of education, all these people who know what they're talking about, and so that the implementation of the laws established by the Congress, signed by the president, can be executed in a way that has meaning and definition. That's how our system has developed constitutionally. And the concept, once again, that yes, indeed, inside those agencies that do have some places around the cabinet table, the president can indeed direct a lot of the policy and procedure of those. But there are many other agencies, for example, the Securities and Exchange Commission, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, recently the subject of the attacks by this president upon that agency, the Federal Trade Commission, the Federal Communications Commission, the National Labor Relations Board, and yes, indeed, even the Federal Reserve, all of those independent agencies. Now, according to what President Donald Trump did on Tuesday of this week, bringing them inside the executive ambit, under his theory that the executive branch alone declares what the law is. Many of those agencies, again, operate on your behalf, on our behalf, providing regulatory enforcement. Yes, indeed, ensuring that the rules and the laws of the Congress are enacted in ways that make sense, and also doing it independent of the political animation for both Democratic presidents and Republican presidents alike. Congress believed that some governmental functions should be performed by bodies with this extra edge of independence from the executive. And that's why they established all of these agencies that have that kind of independence, so that on behalf of you, the laws can be properly executed. So what did Donald Trump do in issuing executive order finally on Tuesday of this past week? First, he purported to abolish the independence of these congressionally created independent agencies. I've just listed some of them, including portions of the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve, which is responsible, again, you know it because it establishes interest rates and attempts to address not only employment issues, but also other economic issues along the way. Hugely important, bringing a portion of that inside the White House. Establishing the independence of those agencies by the legislatures, now brought inside the executive branch, subjecting the heads of all of those agencies to performance reviews and by implication dismissal standards that were not established by Congress, but by the White House Office of Management and Budget. That's what the first portion of this executive order says. The portion of the order is express power. It's a power grab that plainly violates Supreme Court precedent, and there's a lot of it out there, establishing the independence of these agencies. Donald Trump, by virtue of what he did on Tuesday, establishing for the first time since these agencies have been in place that now he alone is responsible for overseeing them, and they are the ones who are supposed to be responsible to him, their leadership, their policies, and their practices. That should have everyone of all parties, whatever your political views are about all of these other policies, very concerned. Second, and this is no less significant, and this is where we get back to this notion, l'état c'est moi, King Henry the 14th. The order also asserts, as to these independent agencies, hold on, the claim that Donald Trump has already made about the rest of the executive branch, that he can ignore Congress's statutory commands about how appropriated money can be spent. We'll talk just a minute from now about the other problem with all of this, and that is that more and more the Department of Justice, when it goes into court to defend the things that Donald Trump is doing in these other substantive areas, more and more, as at least two, if not more, federal judges have said, these judges are acknowledging, are saying that Donald Trump is simply thwarting, is disregarding their orders. That's a hugely, hugely problematic aspect of what this administration is doing. The nonchalant of the declaration that Donald Trump made just on Tuesday reflects, again, his growing confidence that the Congress will not push back on him, that the Supreme Court, which has already articulated this incredibly muscular presidency, that will not be a check against him. And in fact, the February 18th executive order makes a breathtaking assertion that reaches far beyond the mere independence of these agencies and stopping their independence. It declares, get this, that the president and the attorney general of the United States, subject, of course, to the control of the president, shall provide authoritative interpretations of law for the executive branch. Let me read that once again. This executive order on February 18th establishes that it's the president and the attorney general who provide authoritative interpretations of law for the executive branch. When we discuss this further, we'll talk more about exactly how that language is implemented by this executive order. And once again, the stunning way in which it changes the ways in which the separation of powers works in America, Congress, the judiciary, and the executive branch, the ways in which we are now returning to the kinds of things that our founding fathers expressly denied and put behind them. That, as Amicus Law Review continues.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home of Mino and the Mayor.
I'm Earl Ingram, host of The Earl Ingram Show. We're celebrating Black History Month by sharing some powerful interviews and stories featuring Wisconsin's own trailblazers. We're also listening to you because conversations can make a difference.
It's got to be had, and we have to have it on a regular basis, not only on the air, but around the coffee table. I was more optimistic than I am now. America's taken a big backward step.
I do try to have that conversation about racial disparity and give small history lessons as much as I can.
Join us to continue the conversations as we stand together and learn together. And let's celebrate Black History Month every month. I'm Earl Ingram.
The Earl Ingram Show on the Civic Media Radio Network and on the Civic Media app. 97.9 WGBW and WGBW.FM.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel, talking at length, necessarily, in this weekend broadcast, all about what happened on Tuesday of this week. The execution by President Donald Trump of this major executive order that changes America, that changes the ways in which our government works. And yes, indeed, people of all partisan views should be monumentally not just concerned, but distressed by what it is that the president signed off on, not only establishing that all of these independent agencies established by the Congress to be independent of the White House have to submit their proposed regulations to the White House for review before those can go into effect. The executive order asserts a power to block agencies from spending funds on projects or efforts that conflict in any way with presidential priorities, as the president describes them, again, completely eliminating that notion of independence when it comes to executing the law, and declaring that they must accept the president's and the Justice Department's interpretation of the law as binding. And that, undeniably, if you are concerned consuming as you do the history of our Anglo-American jurisprudence, you understand that that is expressly what the Parliament in England, what kings acknowledged could no longer happen, what our own founding fathers rejected way back in 1776. And so, breathtaking language once again that establishes that it's what the president says, and maybe the attorney general in other circumstances. Whatever the president says, that's the law. L'état, c'est moi. What he says is that the president and the attorney general provide authoritative interpretation of a law, and goes on to say this: no employee of the executive branch acting in their official capacity may advance an interpretation of the law as the position of the United States that contravenes, big word, you all know what it means. It means objects to, opposes the president or the attorney general's opinion on a matter of law. No agency in the executive branch can say anything other than what the president says is the law, is in fact the law, including, but not limited, the executive order goes on to say, to the issuances of regulations, of guidance, on positions advanced in litigation. Yes, that's the Department of Justice. And unless it's authorized by the president expressly or in writing by the attorney general. If that language does not make you stop doing whatever you're doing in this weekend and go and take a look at it and read it again for your family, your friends, whatever your political views may be, you should do that this weekend. Donald Trump, my president, your president, is in effect declaring that in all questions of either making law in the form of regulation or interpreting that law in any way, regulatory statutes, regulatory rules and regulations, statutory, constitutional issues, interpretations of the Constitution, the only executive branch opinion is the one that matters. The executive branch alone is the one that decides what the law is. If Donald Trump, let's give some illustrations. If Donald Trump, for example, opines that the SEC regulations do not bind Elon Musk, for example, then that is the statutory authority, that's the regulatory authority of the executive branch from which no SEC commissioner can dissent under this new executive order. If the president, if the White House decides that the procedural protections for immigrants, for example, much in the news these days, in something called the Immigration and Nationality Act, the INA. I suspect that many of you know much about that, who've studied what's going on right now with immigrants in our nation. Implementing regulations are no longer operative. If the law no longer applies to our immigrant populations, the opinion of the executive branch of the White House is authoritative. It's the one that holds. No employee of the Department of Homeland Security, including presumably the immigration judges who decide these things, can disagree. What if the president opines, offers his views on regulations governing oil and the gas industry, or the discharge, for example, of toxic gases into our air, into our water, pollutants into our water? All those kinds of things could be reinterpreted under the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, all those kinds of things. Special privileges to contributors, for example, other people who have curried favor with the chief executive. Those too would be decisions of this authoritarian presidency declaring what the law is, and no dissent. No dissent is allowed under this new executive order. If the president of the United States of America decides, for example, the FBI, we have a new director as of this weekend, his name is Kash Patel, and the Justice Department can legally begin criminal investigations, and we've seen some of that already, or prosecutions against his enemies, his foes that he's articulated during the course of the campaign without any factual basis, then that is the directive that he can give to the Department of Justice, and that is the authoritative interpretation of the law for the executive branch to steal exactly from the language of this stunning executive order coming out of the White House just this past week. All of that coming out of a White House that has now adopted The unitary executive theory, and yes, indeed, that's the way that we're going to close this first hour. You may recall well, listeners of our broadcast and others here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media, talked a lot about this unitary executive theory as a theory. Yes, it's been around since the Reagan administration, implicit if not explicit in Project 2025 and other things were written about during the course of the campaign. It is the notion that these independent agencies do not, in fact, have independence, and that all of the things that, for example, once again, the SEC or the FTC or the FCC, the National Labor Relations Board, the Federal Reserve, all these things that they do for your benefit and our benefit generally in America and, frankly, around the globe, all of those things cannot, should not be independent of the political views and perspectives of a Democratic president, of a Republican president, that instead all of those should be folded inside the executive branch and subject to direction from and directive to these agencies from the president. That's the unitary executive theory. And it was bandied about and people said, well, gee, maybe that's an interesting thing to talk about, but it will not happen. This past Tuesday, the president of the United States of America, my president, your president, adopted that theory and said, yes, it is going to be the mechanism by which we proceed now in America. The authority of the president being absolute with respect to all agencies. Now, the good news here, of course, is like all of these things, it will be subject to review. Undeniably going to be in the federal courts, as all of these other things are. But important to take note here on Amicus of this significant historical event of just this past week, and noting once again what our president has done to bring inside the fold of the White House authorities not contemplated. More of all this on Amicus, a law review.
From Denmark to De Pere, this is 97.9 WGBW. Jane Matinair and Greg Bach.
Coming up on the show, we will break down all of the most recent news and how it affects all of us here in Wisconsin. Plus, this shouldn't be a thing. Don't miss it.
Matinair on air, weekday mornings at 10.
Hey, it's Amanda, and we all know that Northeast Wisconsin has some of the best events around, but trying to find them all can be tricky. So here at WGBW, we decided to do the work for you. Prevent boredom on any night by going to WGBW.fm and click events in the top right corner. You'll never have to spend forever scrolling to find out what's going on in your area. And if you got an event to share, hit us up by emailing info@WGBW.fm. We can work together to have real news and great conversation while giving you the 411 on what's happening in New Wisco.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us. This is 97.9 WGBW Denmark, Green Bay's real news and great conversation, a Civic Media radio station.
ABC News, I'm David Packer. Prayers around the world for Pope Francis, who remains hospitalized for a 10th day in Rome with what the Vatican says is a lung infection. The Vatican today said blood tests show the Pope is in early kidney failure. After Elon Musk's email to federal employees to list five things they accomplished last week or consider themselves out of a job, Musk now appearing to be softening his tone on the initiative, posting on X that, quote, the bar is very low here. On ABC's This Week, New York Congressman Mike Lawler supporting Musk.
As the Department of Government Efficiency moves ahead, what they are seeking to do is ensure that every agency and department is effectively and efficiently doing their job.
One day from the third anniversary of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, President Volodymyr Zelensky saying he would resign his office if Ukraine were allowed to join NATO. President Trump called Zelensky a dictator last week. This is ABC News.